Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. As all of you surely know by this time, Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall has announced his retirement from the United States Supreme Court. Justice Marshall's health has been deteriorating for several years. Although his retirement came as a surprise to many, if not most, of Justice Marshall's friends and supporters. Thurgood Marshall had at least one unique experience. He was the first black ever to serve on the United States Supreme Court. Whatever your view of his judicial philosophy and practice, that is one distinction which cannot be taken from him. Please do not construe what I am about to say as a personal attack against Justice Marshall. Nor should I be accused of racism. I am not attacking Justice Marshall's sincerity or his ability or his dedication to the cause of civil rights. But in my judgment, his decisions, generally speaking, were decidedly detrimental to the cause of racial harmony in the United States. They were not based on the law as outlined in the Constitution, but on what he thought the law ought to be. In other words, Justice Marshall and many other liberal judges have sought to rewrite the Constitution, not to interpret it. He was what is commonly called a judicial activist. He was a man with an agenda, and every interpretation of the Constitution had to harmonize with and to support his personal views. I honestly wish Justice Marshall well in his years of retirement, but I am pleased that he will not serve any longer on the United States Supreme Court. In case you are prone to interpret what I have said as being racially motivated, let me assure you that I was even more pleased with the retirement of Earl Warren and William O. Douglas. Race has absolutely nothing to do with my pleasure at Justice Marshall's resignation. It is his judicial philosophy that has disturbed me so greatly. This nation cannot endure the kind of decisions associated with the names I have mentioned today, Thurgood Marshall, Earl Warren, and William O. Douglas. After Justice Marshall announced his retirement, President George Bush nominated Judge Clarence Thomas as a replacement for Marshall. As expected by court watchers, the nomination of Judge Thomas created a storm of controversy. Justice Marshall was a black man. So is Judge Thomas. So why would some black politicians, the NAACP, civil rights leaders, women's liberationists, and some labor leaders choose to oppose Judge Thomas? Is it because he is educationally or intellectually inferior? Has he been guilty of some heinous crime which would disqualify him for the nation's highest court? Or is it remotely possible that the liberals and radicals want to reject Judge Thomas because of his political and judicial philosophy? Surely liberals would not require a litmus test for a federal judge. On Tuesday, July the 2nd, 1991, the San Francisco Examiner published an in-depth article on Judge Thomas. The article had a number of quotations from prominent American political and academic leaders with regard to Judge Thomas. Ron Brown, chairman of the Democrat Party, calls Judge Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court yet another step in the ideological hijacking of the Supreme Court by the radical right wing of the Republican Party. Page A9. If President Bush had nominated a wild-eyed liberal, would Ron Brown have accused the liberal left wing of the Democrat Party of hijacking the Supreme Court? A nominee for the Supreme Court must have some kind of judicial philosophy. Which would we rather have? A man committed to interpreting the Constitution just as it is written, or one who reads into the Constitution what he wants it to say? Senator Paul Simon, Democrat of Illinois, expresses concern over whether Judge Thomas will champion the rights of all Americans. including the powerless in our society. The duty of a Supreme Court justice is not to champion the rights of all Americans, but to interpret the Constitution of the United States. But who better than a man who grew up powerless to be concerned about the powerless in our nation? Maybe Senator Simon is disturbed that Judge Thomas would not support the cause of feminism or homosexuality or similar movements. Derrick Bell, a black law professor at Harvard, calls President Bush's choice for the Supreme Court an embarrassment. The truth is, Derrick Bell's statement ought to be an embarrassment to blacks and to all other loyal Americans. What could possibly be wrong with nominating a man who deeply respects our American Constitution and is committed to interpreting the Constitution conservatively, the only legitimate way to interpret any document? No judge can be honest with the people or with himself when he seeks from the Constitution a justification for what he believes and what he wants to impose on the American people. Judges are not lawmakers. They are to interpret the law. Surely a law professor at Harvard ought to understand such an elementary principle. Arthur Kropp, president for People of the American Way Action Fund, says, "I can hardly imagine a more troubling choice. This will be a highly controversial nomination. Clarence Thomas has a dismal record on civil rights enforcement. What else would you expect someone from People for the American Way to say about an honorable, respectable, and successful judge? If Judge Thomas were highly vocal in support of radical causes in our society, such as the Women's Liberation Movement, the Gay Liberation Front, the African National Congress, and similar organizations, the story would probably be very different. He would enjoy the endorsement of liberals like Ted Kennedy, Joseph Biden, Howard Metzenbaum, and a host of other liberal academicians, theologians, and women's liberationists." I have given you this brief introduction to our study today in order to explain one of the major errors of the United States Supreme Court and of many lower courts, and that is affirmative action. Many civil rights leaders who are opposing Judge Thomas believe he will not vote for affirmative action programs. I believe they are right and are reading Judge Thomas correctly. Should he support affirmative action? Could he do that and still have any respect for our Constitution? How can anyone support affirmative action without compromising his convictions that all men are created equal? Can anyone harmonize affirmative action with the concept of justice for all? My friends, we want to affirm today and in our lesson next week that affirmative action is always immoral. Since many of us hear words, ideas, and concepts without bothering to investigate their full meaning, it is in order to define affirmative action and affirmative action programs. Stephen H. Giffis, an associate professor of law at Rutgers University School of Law, Newark, New Jersey, has produced a dictionary of legal terms which will help us to understand what affirmative action means. Giffis defines affirmative action as follows: a positive step taken to correct conditions resulting from past discrimination or from violations of the law. He defines affirmative action programs as hiring practices and other employment programs adopted to eliminate discrimination in the employment of minority persons. Such programs are required by federal law. Page 13. Three terms, affirmative action, quotas, and reverse discrimination, are often used interchangeably. Affirmative action involves awarding jobs, positions, educational opportunities, and similar perks on the basis of past discrimination. If your race or social group has been mistreated or abused, you deserve to be given special privileges to compensate for what your predecessor suffered. Governmental sanctioned quotas would demand that certain occupations or professions must have a certain number of blacks, of Hispanics, of Jews, of Chinese, and so on. If the United States has 20% blacks within the population, then every profession or occupation would be required to have 20% blacks. Reverse discrimination would mean trying to correct what our forefathers had to endure by way of prejudice and bias. If Native Americans were abused financially or socially or politically, and they unquestionably were, then we have to make up in our generation and in the generations to come for the way the whites treated the Indians. Some most important questions are in order at this time. What if affirmative action were really applied in our society to everyone whose ancestors were abused, mistreated, and rejected? Is it possible to correct past actions by rewarding the people of our day? If it were possible, and it is not, would it be right and fair? There is hardly a person in the United States or in the world whose forefathers were not adversely affected by the social system or the political system or the religious practices under which they lived. Must we compensate everyone on the face of the earth for the way their parents or grandparents were treated? Some legislative actions and some Supreme Court decisions have leaned in that direction, but there is no justification for reverse discrimination or for quotas or for affirmative action. Let me reason with you for just a moment. Some of my ancestors came to the United States from Ireland. The Irish were the objects of considerable hate and maltreatment when they migrated to our great nation. Should we establish quotas for Irish people to try to remedy the discrimination my Irish forefathers suffered at the hands of some Americans? My people on my father's side have been members of the Churches of Christ for several generations. There have been communities, and probably still are some, where members of the Churches of Christ were not hired for certain industries or businesses or professions. To deny that such has happened to almost all, if not all, religious groups is simply to ignore reality. Must every community allocate a certain number of jobs to make up for the way some members of the Churches of Christ have been mistreated? For years, my parents were very poor, at least from a materialistic viewpoint. There were times in my life when our house was not warm and comfortable. My brothers and sisters and I did not always have enough clothing to shield us from the cold of winter. When my parents bought us pencils, we had to break them into two pieces so that they would go farther among 12 children. We had to share notebook paper or tablets because we could not afford enough full packages of notebook paper or full tablets for all my brothers and sisters who were in school. We each had one pair of shoes for the entire school year. If we wore them out prematurely, as I almost always did, we had to go barefooted for the rest of the year. I'm not telling you this for sympathy. I did not know we were poor. We had enough to eat, a relatively comfortable place to stay, and parents who loved us dearly. But because we were poor, there were many activities at school and in the community in which we were never invited to participate. May I add, however, that our school teachers never treated the Claiborne children as if they were second-class citizens. Since we were occasionally the objects of prejudice and bias, should not the Claiborne children and other children from poor homes be given special privileges in our occupations and professions and in educational opportunities? Since people of all races, black, white, yellow, and brown, and all nations, English, Irish, Dutch, Spanish, Native Americans, Japanese, Chinese, Russian, German, French, and all stations in life, poor, rich, socially disenfranchised, and uneducated, have been discriminated against at least in some communities and at some time, should we not have quotas for all these groups? And what about old people and young people and women? Have they not all been the objects of discrimination? Shall we have affirmative action for all these groups? Where does it end? Where does it end? To be completely fair and honest, affirmative action should never have had a beginning. Frederick J. Krebs of the United States Chamber of Commerce asked, as a society, do we want quality or quotas to determine the composition of our workforce? If our Constitution mandates affirmative action, which it does not and never has, in what areas or occupations or professions will it be applied? Do you want a surgeon to operate on you because of his race or color or creed? Would you not prefer to have a man or a woman who is skilled and concerned and dedicated, regardless of his or her racial, social, political, or religious background? I do not want a Jeffrey Bodine operating on me, even if he has been trained in some affirmative action program. How would you like to fly in one of the giant jet aircraft with a pilot who owes his job to a quota system? Please understand that I am not putting down anyone, regardless of color or race or social condition. I have flown with black pilots, and probably with women pilots. But I do not want someone flying an aircraft in which I am a passenger just because he is black or Hispanic or white. I want the pilots to have all the qualifications, which guarantee safe flight. Do we apply the quota system to our governmental representatives, local, state, and national? Must we elect a certain number of black senators, Hispanic senators, white senators, women senators? How shall we handle the presidency? Elect only blacks, women, and Hispanics for the next 40 or 50 years, since we have never had any of these groups in the White House? I'm not against any of these groups, but we need to elect the people who will do the very best they know how in taking care of governmental responsibilities. Our Supreme Court has sent confusing signals to the American people. On occasion, it has ruled in favor of affirmative action, but it has also ruled against it. One paragraph from Robert Bork's excellent book, The Tempting of America, will help us in understanding the quota system. There is little doubt this intellectual class bias has infiltrated our jurisprudence. The court has upheld government's use of gender preferences, even though the applicable statute flatly prohibited that practice. In Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, four members of the court upheld the constitutionality of racial preferences in the state medical school's admission policies, and the fifth justice, whose position became law, decided that race could not be an absolute criterion, but it could be a factor considered in giving preference to minority applications. There are a number of such holdings approving coercive governmental action in these areas. This appears to be a moralism so strong it overcomes positive law. Page 246. Thomas Sowell, a distinguished black economist and a political conservative, has written extensively against reverse discrimination or affirmative action. In his outstanding 1984 book, Civil Rights, Rhetoric or Reality, Sowell makes this pertinent observation. It is now estimated that 70% of the American population is entitled to preferential treatment under affirmative action. Page 14. In other words, if we were to seek to rectify all the past injustices which have been perpetrated against women, blacks, Irish, poor people, Roman Catholics, we would then be discriminating against the 30% who may not have had ancestors which were abused because of race or creed or national origin or social status. One chapter in Thomas Sowell's book has the title, From Equal Opportunity to Affirmative Action. Sowell affirms that the very meaning of civil rights has changed over the past several years. Initially, he says, civil rights meant, quite simply, that all individuals should be treated the same under the law, regardless of race, religion, sex, or other social considerations. But today, many civil rights activists are demanding the concept of equal results, and not just equal individual opportunity. Page 37. My friends, it does not take a Solomon to realize that attempting to assure equality of results is neither an American democratic ideal nor a Christian concept. Equal opportunity laws and policies, Sowell says, require that individuals be judged on their qualifications as individuals without regard to race, sex, age, and such like. Affirmative action requires that they be judged with regard to such group membership, receiving preferential or compensatory treatment in some cases to achieve proportional representation in various institutions and occupations. Page 38. I've already indicated some of the changes the civil rights movement has undergone. Affirmative action has also been changed from its original purpose. According to Thomas Sowell, the expression affirmative action was first used by President John F. Kennedy in 1961. President Kennedy wanted to guarantee fairness in hiring and in promoting employees. He sought to have information about employment made available to those who normally might not be included in the business and professional communities. He wanted people to enjoy various freedoms without regard to group membership. President Kennedy's executive order demanded that federal contractors should take affirmative action to ensure that the applicants are employed and that employees are treated fairly during employment without regard to race, creed, color, or national origin. Page 39. Some senators and representatives were deeply concerned that the 1964 Civil Rights Act would be a quota bill. One of the chief sponsors of the bill was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Senator Humphrey made every effort to assure his colleagues that the Civil Rights Act did not require an employer to achieve any kind of racial balance in his workforce by giving preferential treatment to any individual or group. Senator Joseph Clark, another sponsor of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, insisted that the act will not require an employer to change existing seniority lists, even though such lists might have differential impact on blacks as the last hired and the first fired. Incidentally, Thomas Sowell affirms that opinion polls show a majority of blacks opposed to preferential treatment, as is an even larger majority of women. Page 40. Who then encouraged the adoption of the quota system, which is so dear to the hearts of so many liberal politicians, academicians, and theologians? The American people as a whole are against affirmative action. The majority of blacks and of women do not favor it. But federal administrative agencies and the courts led the change from the prospective concept of individual equal opportunity to the retrospective concept of parity of group representation or correction of imbalances. Pages 40 and 41. Our study today has set the tone for a lesson at our next meeting on what the Scriptures teach about discrimination. I have shown today just how illogical and even impossible it is to promote and to enforce affirmative action or quotas. The very concept should strike every American as being undemocratic, unreasonable, unworkable, and unwanted, at least unwanted by most Americans of all ethnic and racial backgrounds. What we have in administrative offices in Washington and in many of our courts are people who decide they know what is best for the rest of us. They twist the Constitution to make it fit their agenda, even if that agenda makes most Americans uncomfortable in their positions. The Lord willing, our next lesson will show from the Scriptures that all kinds of discrimination, including affirmative action, are unscriptural and therefore unchristian. We thank you for listening today. May God continue to bless you.